Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today we'll be talking about a program called the Connected PhD with my guests, Dr. Alyssa Canelli and Dr. Jonathan Anjaria. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Thank you so much. We're delighted to be here.
I'm so glad you're here and we get to talk about this wonderful way of looking at the PhD as something that students can really make work for them and for their future career goals. But before we jump into that, will you both please tell us a bit about yourselves? John, could we start with you?
Yeah, sure. So I have two roles at Brandeis right now. So I am an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology, and I'm also the faculty director of professional development for the graduate school. So for the past 10 years, I've been teaching at Brandeis. I've been director of graduate studies, and I have, you know, mentored and taught and interacted with many graduate students. And over those years, I saw, you know, what's working and what is not working about the graduate programs. A year and a half ago, in collaboration with an incoming dean, we thought that there's just much more, we needed more attention to, like, being a little bit more deliberate about professional development and just providing more help for just to enable graduate students to be prepared to pursue a variety of careers after graduation. And so that's what led to us starting this new position that I'm in now, which is the faculty director of professional development. So a lot of my work intersects with this connected PhD program we'll talk about today, and I guess we can get into that more as we continue with the conversation.
We will, for sure. I want to give Dr. Canelli a few minutes to introduce herself as well, please.
Sure. My name is Alyssa, and I did my PhD at Emory University, and I graduated in late 2016, I believe. And I'm one of those, I'm one of the cohort of small but growing PhDs who never got a faculty position, but is still making a career in higher ed administration. So my current role is the Assistant Dean of Academic Affairs in the graduate school. And so I do curriculum and program review, lots of things with student fellowships and a variety of different odds and ends having to do with those things, and also really kind of working, you know, in partnership with the dean of the graduate school to achieve their goals and their vision. One of the things that I like to always lead with is that I am a mom with twins. My twins are now 7 years old, and my daughter has trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome. So I'm also active in the Down syndrome community here in Massachusetts.
Thank you both for telling us about yourselves. I wonder if we could circle back a little bit and we could hear a bit about your own journeys through higher ed. When you were finishing up high school and looking forward, did you envision where you are now? And did you even envision what your college major would be? John, could we start with you?
That's great. That's a great question. When I was finishing high school, I was very much involved in the sciences, and it was like biological, some research programs. But then when I started in college, I took an anthropology course, and I just loved the approach of anthropology. And so I dived into that as an undergraduate. One thing I often tell students is, like, don't use my career trajectory as a model. Like, I don't think I did the right thing. I was an undergrad. I loved anthropology. So I thought, okay, well, I should just go to anthropology graduate school. And I don't think that's actually a good idea. I mean, it worked. I got lucky. And that's how academia often is. There's just a lot of luck involved. I don't think that's actually a very deliberate, good way of approaching things. Because what I realized, I loved the anthropology. I loved the research. And so graduate school really worked for me because I liked, the PhD is ultimately it's a research degree, and I really love the research. And so I got my PhD in 2008 from University of California at Santa Cruz. I was attracted to that program because it had a reputation at the time for kind of doing things differently and doing anthropology differently. After 2008, then I graduated and I had an assistant professor, a visiting position at Smith College, and then a tenure track position at Bard College, and now I'm at Brandeis. There's just one looking back though is, and it's funny just comparing like my own trajectory and what I'm doing now is, the work I do now is I really focus on the multiple career possibilities. So for example, like if it's research that you're interested in, I see now that there's so many opportunities to do research. Like for instance, in anthropology, social sciences, my work is qualitative research, and that can be done in an urban, government sector. It could be done in industry, nonprofits, and higher ed. But looking back at from my own perspective, my own background, I didn't see things like that. Like when I was in graduate school, I was very much I thought that only research only happens in academic contexts, and the only way to pursue life where the centers on research, you have to be at a university, and that is such an incorrect assumption. It's totally wrong. I was wrong, and so much of my work now is just to correct that myth, which I unfortunately see is still very very pervasive. One regret I have looking back is I wish I had known more about all the possibility things you can do with, again, I'm sticking with anthropology, but it really could be any discipline, but to think about when you're in graduate school that there's so many things you could do with the skills you're developing and the experience you're getting. I guess I wish I had explored that more in the past. I mean, I love being a professor, but I'm seeing how there's so many other things you could possibly do with the skills that you acquired during graduate school.
I want to ask you one more question, and then I want to ask Alyssa to answer the same one I posed to John, which is, where do you think that assumption came from? You said the assumption about, you're going to go to anthropology graduate school, and then you're going to go on this academic trajectory. Where was that assumption coming from, and why did nothing dissuade it as you went forward, do you think?
When I was in graduate school, it's two things. Like, the external thing is there was never any examples shown to me of people doing anthropology outside of the academy. So if I look back at who are the invited speakers, or who do you read in class, who do you talk to, and then all the subtle things of who do people refer to as anthropologists? It's always this world of the assumption implicitly is that anthropology only happens in a university setting, and again that's not true. Most people with anthropology PhDs are not working in university settings. So I definitely that's where I soaked it up. But I think also, I should also personally, I think often academia presents itself as this ideal space that's like a retreat from the rest of the world. That it's like, often academia presents itself as uniquely ethical, maybe uniquely separate from capitalism and all the other bad things in the world. And that's incorrect, and it's a mistaken it's not very productive for people's personal lives as well.
But it is pervasive in academia.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
Thank you so much. Alyssa, can you tell us about when you were looking ahead to college and what you thought you'd do afterwards and how much that does or doesn't match your life now?
Sure. This is so fascinating to listen to, just as a side note, as a listening to my colleagues' experience, because I think that we actually come from, I think, different sides of this, but actually have ended up in a similar place. So my experience is that I'm a first generation college student, I don't know about, what was it, 8 years ago, that book Hillbilly Elegy came out, and that literally is where I grew up. It's where my family is from. And in the back of my head, I've been writing a response to Hillbilly Elegy for like 8 years because of some of the things I take issue with in terms of that book and that author's perspective. But it really was for me, my mother and my grandmother were and are, well, my grandmother just passed, but she was one of the most brilliant people I've ever known, and without any sort of formal education. And my mother also, she's a nurse, but she had to work her way through that as a single parent, night school while I was a child. And one of the things that my grandmother and my mother always said to me was that education is the way out. So from the time I was small, it was the education was the way out. It was the way to move social classes. It was the way to have the life that they always wanted me to have. And so when I kind of went through the college application process in a very kind of haphazard way. My graduating public high school class was over 1,000. I was just sort of kind of on my own and kind of absorbing information. And I happened to apply to Smith College because I was in love with Sylvia Plath and she was the writer, and she filled all those angsty things in me. So I was just the idea of going to Smith College, where Sylvia Plath was and where her archives were, was the thing for me. And I got in, and it was really the single most life-changing thing of my life, my decision. And to that extent, my mother and my grandmother were very, very true. That educational decision changed my life. And I think from that point on, I've always been a writer and a reader. So being an English major was completely a no-brainer for me. And I loved it. I fell in love with every single professor I had. I loved what they did. I loved being part of these conversations. And for me, I just, it was a very natural thing to like, oh, I want to be like them. I want to do what they're doing. This is something that I loved. But also on the flip side, as a first generation student, I have been working full time since I was 14 years old. So I have I've had so many part-time gigs, and I worked in a variety of stores in the mall all through high school and college. And, even after college, I was working in a publishing company, and then I was having a bookkeeping side gig as well. And because you got to pay your bills, you got to do the hustle. And so I think one of the things that I internalized was that the hustle, these side gigs, were not important. They were the ways to pay my bills, but they weren't going to get me to where I actually needed to go. So eventually, when I made it to graduate school down at Emory University doing the PhD, I still kept doing this, right? So I was, I had a fairly generous 12-month support stipend, which is supposed to, you're supposed to do your research and your coursework full time, but I was always taking on these other gigs. And those other gigs actually tended to be sort of actually within the university. So I was working with the Center for Faculty Development and Excellence on this, helping to put on a conference symposium and getting paid for that, taking on editing gigs. I was a freelance editor. And was one of those things where, lots of grad students did this, but it was quiet. We never told our advisors, or if our advisors knew, they kind of looked the other way. Or if you were getting behind in milestones, then it was just sort of like there would be a conversation about you needing to refocus your energies and not spend time doing other things other than your research. So kind of fast forward to sort of where I am now. and at Brandeis University and sort of, and with the Connected PhD, one of the really big things I have seen is sort of that the Connected PhD helps students make those side gigs legible, because the key thing is it's those skills and those side gigs, those actual experiences, those actual deliverables, those concrete things that actually help them become much more competitive in a variety of career tracks, whether they're in academia or not. But it's those actual experiences and those things like, yes, I can manage deadlines, I can produce a deliverable, I've had experience dealing with bureaucracy and administration, I can do administrative tasks that actually really kind of, I think, charge the PhD students' experiences and allow them to kind of build on more experiences to actually chart their course and their career pathway in multiple different ways that can both intersect within the academy, but out external to it as well.
I resonate so much of what you're saying resonates with me. I have a strong bias towards how much I loved going to college and to graduate school, and how even with funding, yeah, I had so many side gigs, but like you said, making it legible, I was also discouraged from talking about it too much. And for many students, even still, there's a concern that if you do, then the university will pull more of your funding.
Exactly.
And so I like that you are making things visible and telling students that their skills matter. I still struggle to talk about the skills that I have because so much of them didn't seem to fit the mold or were actively discouraged from being talked about. So it sounds like a lot of your lived experiences came together in your desire to create the Connected PhD. Can you tell us how this initiative at Brandeis came about? I know it was funded by the Mellon Foundation, but how did the pieces come together?
Sure. I mean, what exactly happened was that we at Brandeis, under our previous dean, Eric Chaslow, we were wrapping up our last Mellon grant, which was the dissertation year fellowships that many institutions got. And then Mellon, as the foundation, decided, like, you know what, we're not really having an impact on time to degree here. And so we're going to change our funding strategy for higher ed and doctoral institutions. And actually, Len Cassuto does a really good job in his book, The New PhD, kind of explaining sort of those transitions in the Mellon Foundation and other granting agencies. But essentially, we were looking, you know, Eric and I were looking at sort of, okay, so where do we go next? And he and I had a sequence of multiple conversations along with Michael Duddlebach, who was our head of corporate and foundation relations here at Brandeis, about, you know, what could we ask Mellon for? You know, we knew that we couldn't go back and ask for the same things, but so we had to kind of think about it differently. And I was coming fresh off of my experiences, you know, in graduate school. And I have to say that both Michael and Eric really treated me, you know, even though I wasn't a faculty member, I was just this kind of the staff position assistant dean, they treated me as an intellectual equal in this project. And so Eric and I, you know, created this idea of this Connected PhD, which was also linked to other things that were going on across the nation, of course, right? So as I finished up my PhD at Emory, the then dean at Laney Graduate School, Lisa Tedesco, was also working on these kinds of things. You know, these small mini grants for programs and departments and students to develop these kinds of concrete skills to expand, you know, their own research into more public venues to really make these connections. So we wrote that grant. Mellon, you know, was generous and they funded it. It was a 4-year grant, $750,000. And they basically said, see what you can do. They were, you know, I think that Mellon is a little cynical at this point about how little change has happened in doctoral training programs over the past 20 years. But they are funding these kinds of, or they were at the time funding these kinds of seed grants to see, you know, can this be the kind of thing where we can harness both faculty and students to generate their own change instead of coming from the top down. So I think that, you know, we're moving into the fourth year now, which is the final year of the grant. And, you know, we can talk more about it, but I think we've seen some really, really positive progress from our goals and from our metrics about, you know, where we want to go from here. I'll turn it over to John, because he kind of came in, into his role. I think the first year he may have observed Connected PhD rolling out. And then as he came into his role as faculty director of professional development at the graduate school, he and I had a very, you know, very natural collaboration with this, because the goals of what he's trying to do really intersect with the Connected PhD, and there's a really nice synergy back and forth with the work that we do.
John, would you like to pick up on that?
Yeah, sure. One thing that we've seen in not just at Brandeis but at graduate PhD programs across the country is that there is this very sharp divide between the conversations happening in departments or between students and advisors on one hand, and then the conversations that happen at the graduate school level, like whether it's the professional development office or the dean's office or the office, what Alyssa's work as well. And so there was a need to bridge that divide. I mean, even what Alyssa just said, we're talking about in Alyssa's account of this, the quote unquote, the side hustles or the jobs that students take on or any financial issues. I mean, what we saw is that students are often not comfortable talking with their advisors about anything financially related. So whether it's a job or even if it's a financial concern. And that's because the students are getting sometimes explicit or implicit signals from advisors that relationship, that this is an out of bounds topic for their advisors. The assumption is that when students interact with their advisors or other faculty members, it should only be about ideas, because this assumption of that just like this relationship is all about developing the idea further. But of course, as Alyssa showed, said that that's just half of the student. I mean, of course, we all have personal lives. Students have, of course, obviously there's major financial issues, small stipends, etc. And so, and then of course, career concerns and career needs. And that, so our goal is to bring this together as one package. And then my position in particular is conceived to bridge this very sharp divide between a simple way of putting it is like there's this assumption that like the departmental conversations are all about the ideas, and then everything at the graduate school level is about like the practical stuff, which I think is such so ridiculous and such an unproductive divide that hurts everybody. And so we're trying to make that connection. So I do that focusing on careers and professional development. I heard it was in Katina Rogers in your previous podcast where she said that she talked about a career development that is in along the lines informed by scholarly values. I think that was her term, the scholarly values. And I love that term, because that's really how I see it, is I don't see that working with students to plan for a variety of career options, I don't see that as somehow a distraction from their scholarly pursuits or somehow like a deviation from it. But actually, it really can enhance and improve their research. So working with students on thinking about, but working back from what their career goals are, I can talk with students about, what are the potential audiences they might want for their dissertation? What's the format of their dissertation? What is the best way that they can convey their research? That can lead to discussions about potential for, community collaborations or making their work more publicly oriented. And then also connects to developing more concrete skills that naturally flows to thinking about connections between their work, their dissertation work, and people perhaps in industry. So there doesn't have to be this sharp divide between career thinking on one hand and scholarly pursuits on the other, but there's a natural overlap between the two.
That's such an interesting point, John, because I that whole point about scholarly values informing career and professional development, because one of the things that I've had so many conversations with current PhD students about is how their gigs actually help them think about time management, think them about their research, their writing in different ways. So I think it's very common for PhD students to get to this writing stage and, they freeze with this perfectionism and sort of the idea that they have to do everything so perfectly. But I think, you know, when you're working in an administrative role, or if you're doing a quick, you know, 6-week project for something, you realize that it's the deliverable that counts, and that nobody expects this small term deliverable to be perfect. It's a snapshot in time that's accomplishing 2 or 3 things in order to move the organization or the project forward. And so I've actually really seen students kind of bring that back to their own research and their own ways of managing their academic pursuits and saying, oh, wait a second, like this is always a work in progress. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, it has to serve two, I'm trying to get these 2 main goals accomplished through this paper, this article, this dissertation. And it kind of actually frees them up to kind of look at the work, as opposed to looking at it as this sort of transcendental calling and this knowledge that they're creating and uncovering. It kind of allows them to kind of, I think, maybe kind of depersonalize a little bit and just say, yeah, this thing that I'm writing, you know, it has a beginning, middle, and end. You know, I can track it, I can do it, I can get it done and move forward and get to the next thing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can we talk a bit about internships? So many college and grad students do internships, and a large number of internships are not paid. They're volunteer jobs. And that eliminates so many students who don't have intergenerational wealth or a partner who's supporting them while they're in school. They can't afford to do an unpaid job, even if it looks great on their CV or it impresses their advisor. And I was looking through your website about what the Connected PhD offers, and it sounds like you have funding available if a student wants to do an internship that doesn't pay. You can then pay them.
Absolutely. And I think that this is sort of, you see this at the undergraduate level in many institutions where the Career Center or, you know, different entities on campus, you know, host sort of this, at Brandeis is called the World of Work Fellowships, where there's an understanding that if students want to go into nonprofit organizations for an internship that are unpaid, they can apply for funding at the institution to support them during their summer work. So it's the same kind of principle that we have at the Connected PhD, with the understanding that most of our, obviously, you know, in PhD students who are outside of the STEM fields and outside of like the computing data analysis fields, where you actually can get very, very high paying internships in the summer. But in these other fields, you know, you're looking at by and large, you know, nonprofit people, organizations that don't have a lot of funding. So this is incredibly, I think, empowering for these students to be able to clear their plate. So I think one of the things that we found with students is that they've got to make the money some way or another. And, you know, if it's a choice between, oh, I'm going to go work as a server in a restaurant over the summer and make $6,000 versus I could go have an unpaid internship and work on this project with this nonprofit, and I can do X, Y, and Z that will actually will intersect with my research questions, which will help me develop these skills. And I can also get, you know, funding from the university to pay for that. they would much rather have the internship than go serve at a restaurant for the summer. So I think that that's one of the key things that we recognize for students, that, you know, they need to be able to, they have to make the money somehow. And if they can, if we can provide the funding so they can have these experiences that move them towards a professional development and holistic goals like this, that's what we can provide.
John, what are some of the positive effects you've seen that have happened with the connected PhD internships?
Well, I mean, one positive effect is that that I've seen students can see the significance of their research in a new light. So I'll just begin with one example, like one of the first examples of the students I worked with. So she had just completed an internship, and it was with a small library and archive. And the difference, and so if we're, there's such a, we what we allow through our internships is that students are working as an archive, like let's in this case an example of an archive, they're working as an archive or as a staff member in an institution and thinking about you know, how can they communicate the, let's say like there's certain documents or certain collections in that library, and how can the outer, the rest of the world like become better aware of what what's there. So the automatically like it in the internship, the people are encouraged to think about audience, thinking about how to communicate your scholarship in a clear and accessible way. And then, of course, also understanding how institutions work, of course, the funding structure and all that. And so what the student told me was that they, as a result of working in this archive as a staff member, that they saw the like how the other people were seeing the significance of their own dissertation research. And so like it, they said that the relevance of their dissertation research was revealed to them in a whole different way compared to when they were talking with their advisors. Because, and this is where it gets to like, why the internships get to the core of, you know, why it can really change in a positive way, change the PhD, is that traditionally a PhD dissertation in the humanities and social sciences means a proto-monograph, a single author proto-monograph, so that's the format, and the audience is going to be other scholars or maybe a small group of other academics, but realistically it's just going to be the committee and that's it. But through these internships, it offers the chance for people to see that, well, maybe there can be other audiences for, you know, my research, and maybe that, you know, my research has relevance beyond the disciplinary conversations. And then also changes in form, that when through internships, there people are get exposed to, you know, learning skills in whether it's audiovisual stuff or digital media, and so then they can explore about how potentially are communicating their dissertation research through these other mediums to enable them to go beyond that proto monograph model. And then finally, of course, there's the job. I mean, we haven't been talking about like. Key thing too is that it opens up job opportunities. I mean, the reason that we promote internships so much and is that in conversations I've had. So for, you know, as part of my work, I've been interviewing dozens of, you know, first Brandeis alumni who are working in industry, and then people in other institutions who have PhDs in social sciences and humanities. And when I asked them, you know, what is one thing that they wish they had done during their PhD, or what one thing that could have, you know, been different that would have helped them in their career, they all point to internships, because they say that when you complete a PhD, you have the subject area expertise, you also have skills and, you know, synthesizing lots of information and in writing and all that, and maybe teaching, but of course that depends on the institution. But one thing that's often employers find lacking is they say, well, where is your relevant work experience. That's something that's often missing in the PhD program. So providing internships really fills in that gap. So then students can leave both having the skills as well as having the relevant work experience.
One of the things I noticed on your website was that you had offered webinars, and some of the things the webinars did was coach students in how they're going to write a cover letter, how they're going to write a CV. Can you talk about some of these things that you both are doing to help students see in themselves what makes them marketable, what makes them ready to go into the job market? Because I graduated with no clue. I'll just out myself. I had no clue what was good about me or what I'd learned. I was just really confused about what I'd been doing because I understood it only in an academic context.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because that's the culture of academia. I mean, this is the thing. I've come to see there's two, when we think about a given discipline, so let's say anthropology, that's my discipline, that there's actually two anthropologies. And there's two histories, two Englishes. There's the anthropology that's the ideas, which is the books we read, the ethnographies, the theory, and all that, and all the ideas. And then there's anthropology, the profession. And this applies for every discipline. And so what the mistake happens is that we go through doctoral education focusing only on the first one, which is the ideas. And then at the end, we realize, oh, wait, there's also this whole thing, the profession. We need to get a job. We need to actually have a salary to pay rent and do all that, and then let alone deal with promotions and everything else. And so the second part, the anthropology, the discipline as profession, gets completely ignored in most PhD programs. And that leads to what you just said, which is people don't, we're all in the same boat. You graduate and you realize, like, wait, how do we even do an interview? How do we, I've observed that often, in graduate school, we're not even, graduate students aren't even told, like, what is the difference between an assistant and associate professor or a lecturer or an adjunct emeritus. And this is, of course, what people refer to as the hidden curriculum. So there's so much that is just implicit that is not shared. And so that's the goal of these seminars, is just to make these implicit things explicit. So I begin with, this semester, we have a series of seminars that are meant just to explain the reality of the profession of academia. So part of it is the academic job process. So we had one seminar on, how to apply to academic jobs. But I really focus on the inner workings of search committees. And I've searched as a faculty member. I've been on many search committees. And also I've, taught in liberal arts, different kinds of institutions, liberal arts colleges, as well as R1. And so I've talked about, what are the conversations like in search committees, how do certain candidates succeed and not, and what makes them work. And then we're also having other events. So coming up, we have an event called What Does a Professor Do? And I'm really looking forward to that one, because that one, we've invited four faculty members, and each one represents a different institution. So there's people from community colleges, liberal arts colleges, teaching intensives, R1. And I'm just going to chat with them about what are their expectations for the kind of work they do, like how much time are they expected to work with students, do admin stuff, teaching, research. And the reason I do this is because I see that there's just no, in graduate school, like, students don't have an opportunity to really learn about what does it mean to be a professor in different contexts.
I would just add to what John said, in the sense of, like, these nuts and bolts of, like, how to write a cover letter, how to think about how to convert a CV to a resume and vice versa, and how they're different. This is like classic, genres, right? They're conventions to these genres, and like they're actually fairly easy to learn. They're not challenging in the sense of, it doesn't require a PhD to learn how the conventions of a genre. But I think, like John said, like so much of this, I think a lot of faculty just expect PhD students to learn by osmosis, because honestly, we kind of did that sort of, if you go into any sort of humanities seminar, there's, as John mentioned, it's about the ideas, it's about the critique, and you learn by watching the faculty members do these things as well, and you learn through doing it yourself. So it's not like anyone actually sits down and tells you, okay, this is how a humanities seminar works, and here are the moves you make, and here are the things you say, and here's what happens. And so we actually are really good at learning, just through observing and through taking it in and teaching ourselves. And so I think that when people get to this point of, like, actually, thinking about, CVs and resumes and cover letters and interviewing and networking, they realize, like, oh, there's no model here for me to absorb this through. And so they get a little frozen, I think, and a little bit overwhelmed. But, you know, when you have these kinds of webinars where you can actually, you know, sit down and say, sit down with a group of people, you know, and you record it for, you know, future reference, you can say, oh, this is the component. Here's how to think about this, you know, this line in the CV and how, what it means in the resume, or, you know, there are ways that you can actually, you know, the whole format needs to be upended to translate into a resume, into what those kinds of employers are looking for. So I think that those are really helpful, concrete things. And I think one of the things that frustrates me is that I have heard so many times brilliant faculty members, absolutely brilliant scholars who could teach themselves anything in the world that they wanted to. They, when they're confronted with these kinds of things, they kind of throw up their hands and just say, I don't know anything about that. I couldn't possibly have a conversation with my advisees about this. It's so outside of my expertise. There's just no way I could offer any support. So let's push you off, you know, to the, you know, career center, because it's just not something I could talk about, because I have no idea what to do with it.
Yep. That's true. Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest. What we're calling for here is a change in what it means to be a professor, because that response that Alyssa just described, and I hear the same thing all the time. Faculty are having that resistance because they're feeling, this is not what I signed up for. It's not what it means to be. It's not in my job description as a professor. That for many faculty, there's an assumption that, you know, faculty members means it's only about, we're focusing on the ideas, and that's it. And anything else is a distraction or a deviation or somehow something that's, you know, lesser than. And of course, it's, you know, there's many structural reasons for that too. It's built in. They look at how all universities do promotions. It's all based, you know, for tenure track, it's all based on what you publish. It's not based on, you know, your mentorship of students. Like that's seen, you don't get benefits for being a good mentor. I mean, you don't get a salary raise for that. You get a salary raise for publishing books. So I think, you know, what Alyssa and I are saying is like, it will involve a change in what it means to be a professor. And I think that old model is not working for students, and it's definitely not equitable. And also, as Alyssa said, like, it's not that hard to make this change. I mean, this is where I can, you know, share some of my personal stuff. Is like, so much of my focus is on showing students like how to get jobs in industry, for example. And like, that's something that I knew nothing about. Like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I had no idea where anthropologists work or where people with a history PhD work. And so I just took it on over the last 5 years. Like I approached this like any other research I've done. Like it's my research. I mean, now it's like LinkedIn. I joke like LinkedIn is my research. Now, I mean, I focus like every day I'm on LinkedIn, and the reason I'm on it is I want to learn like where do people with social science and humanities PhDs work now, and what kind of conversations are they having? And so like, it's not, as Alyssa said, it's like not that hard for faculty to do this.
What are some takeaways that you'd like to offer to listeners? So many students like their PhD program, but they're aware that it's not a connected PhD, it's a disconnected PhD. And there are professors working in those programs who would like to do differently or offer differently, and they have no idea where to start. What about what you have learned and implemented could you offer to listeners so they can start to make change where they are?
Well, so it really, yeah, so if I'm speaking to, you know, if you are a graduate student now listening to this, I do want to begin by saying it's not your job to change your department, because I have seen that sometimes. It's as a graduate student, like you're not getting paid enough to change your department and to deal and to fight that fight. If you're a faculty member, yes, you are getting paid, that you should challenge that. And of course, if you're untenured, it's challenging. So if you're a tenured faculty member, then yes, try to make some of these changes. So I can speak. So it really matters what audience we're speaking to. So for, let's say for graduate students, I would say, please just, you know, remember that those faculty members who are pushing back against you getting that internship or that job or trying to do things differently, like they have a very comfortable salary. They're probably, you know, they have a semi-permanent job or permanent job even. And so graduate students, you know, just do what you think is best for yourself, number one. And also always think first, fall back to like, what was it that you love about academia, you know, your discipline? Like, is it, like, why are you in grad school to begin with? It's always important to ask yourself that question. And so is it the, you know, are you here because you love reading these books? Or is it, are you here because you want to write one of those books? Or is it, do you want to teach some of the stuff? And once you have the answer to that question, that could really open up various career possibilities. And also, it's totally fine if you feel like this is not working for you. I mean, it's totally fine to quit. I know people have a lot of anxiety about that, but it's, you know, it's not working for you. It's fine. I mean, it's you know, your life. So let's say, for example, let's say you really love the teaching part, but not the research. Like, let's say you hate writing, but you really love teaching, and you're a second year of a PhD. Then look into all the possible, you know, teaching, you know, what's out there. So, like, for example, consider like community college teaching, if that's something that you're really interested in, like teaching at an access oriented institution. That's something that it's very likely, like, even your most, you know, again, faculty who are like most out, you know, encouraging, are going to have a little bit of a limited ability to help you, because by definition, they're working in an R1. So in your second year of grad school, if you're interested in community college teaching, you know, connect with community college faculty. It's just like, you know, ask to chat for a few minutes or have coffee, talk to find alumni who might work in those institutions, and then maybe try to get some teaching gigs at a community college. And then most importantly, like, really be active in, you know, centers for teaching and learning in your institution. And be active in thinking actively about pedagogy. The reason I'm using that as one example is that once you figure out what that career goal is, like, that's going to have you approach the PhD differently than how your committee might encourage you, because your committee is going to encourage you to focus on the dissertation and on that scholarly monograph for academics. And so you need to, like, have a clear sense that whether or not that's really works for you or not. And I'll be honest, like, for me personally, it did work for me. Like, I really liked it. Like, I'm literally writing a book. Like, that's what I do. I write books. So I'm not against book writing. Like, that's what I personally do. But I also see that that's not what everyone likes. And as a faculty member, what I'm trying to change is, like, this assumption that, like, just because it works for me, like, we should all be able to explore, like, take out of academia what we like, and, you know, you know, explore our research, like, you know, communicate our research in the way that we find that's personally most appropriate.
And I'd like to, ask you the same question, please.
Yeah. I think for graduate students, I would very much echo what John is saying. And I would also kind of encourage them to kind of do some, I don't know how to put this, self-reflection, whether I'm a big fan of therapy. I'm a big fan of support networks and mentors outside of academia. But one of the things I would say is that you, as John said, this degree is about you and your life. And I think that there is a, you know, in the culture of academia, PhD students are infantilized. And, you know, I think there's a very classic sort of, you know, cycle where I think, you know, as you near the end of the PhD program, part of what's difficult is, like, all of a sudden, like, you've been tied to the opinion of 1 to 3 faculty members for 5 years, and suddenly you now have to exercise your own judgment. And I think some people get, really struggle with that. But I would really encourage, you know, students, you know, someone somewhere, I forget the attributions, that, you know, become, I don't like this phrase, but the CEO of your own career, or the CEO of your own PhD, or kind of think of, you're the agent, you are making the decisions, and own it, and you can make those decisions. And I would say, you know, and along with that, you know, people doing a PhD, they're in the time of life where things happen. You know, they're caregivers, they're creating families, family members are ill or dying. There are a variety of different things happening, and that it's okay to make decisions based on life factors. I think that faculty members can be better at supporting this kind of thing, as opposed to just sort of different, you know, career pathways. I think faculty members tend to, you know, at least in my experience and in the community around me, that, you know, are very empathetic for these kinds of life things. But these life things can determine choices. And I'll be very honest here. when, you know, my wife, you know, I'm married to a woman. And so when I was looking at going on the academic job market, and then we got pregnant with twins, and we knew through a prenatal diagnosis that our daughter had trisomy 21 and also had a major heart defect that needed to be fixed by open heart surgery when she was an infant, it completely took the academic job market off the table for me. I wasn't willing to go chase a visiting position out in Alabama or Arkansas or North Dakota, you know, as a lesbian family with a daughter with special needs who would need to be needed to have care of a world-class children's hospital. So I made decisions that option was not, you know, for me. And so then I looked more, I had a geographic constraint. And so I looked for positions, you know, within my geographic constraint, and I still wanted to be in higher ed in some way, shape or form. And that's how I landed at Brandeis doing the administrative work that I'm doing that I actually really love, to be honest. I actually think it's a great fit for me. And I think, you know, as opposed to John, I think this is kind of where it comes into terms of self-reflection, is that I'm a person who I actually think at heart, I'm a generalist. I love knowing a lot about a lot of different things. And while I loved also the deep dive in terms of my content and the work that I did and the research and the publications I had, there's something really amazing about my role where I can actually go into the division of science and I can learn about what's happening in STEM fields and I can support students who are doing that kind of work. I'm learning so many things all the time that I love. And I think I realized that in graduate school that I was able to carry forward, which was, I think, really helpful. And I really encourage students to really think about that, you know, that this is not just, you know, there's just not a single pathway, you know, in terms of their own interests, but what are their different strengths and what are things that, you know, you could see working in different forms in different sectors. And then from the faculty side, what I would say is that, you know, the graduate school is not your enemy. you know, the graduate school, and I think, you know, and I think most graduate school deans, in my experience, you know, they do care deeply about the mission of the institution, the mission of graduate education. And I think that there are ways productively we've been able to use a connected PhD to drive and to support curricular change. And I know that John and I have been a little bit negative in this interview about faculty and faculty perspectives, but I will say that we have seen some fairly significant curricular changes from the connected PhD, where the faculty are having these hard conversations. They have a couple of change leaders who are like John, feel very strongly about these things, and they're doing the work in their department to think about what does the PhD actually do in our discipline? How are we connected to these national conversations? What is the MLA saying about these things? What are the resources of the AHA? What's the job market analysis? You know, how do we look at our curriculum and rethink it? How do we open up space in our requirements to maybe we actually do require an external internship for our doctoral degree? So I think these things are happening, and I would really encourage faculty to sort of be open to these conversations and to, you know, be open to partnering with their graduate school administration, because I think that's one of the things that we're connected to is, you know, we're connected on the national level, and we can see also patterns across disciplines. I think one of the things that happens, I think, with faculty is that you tend to get to a place where you're like, you only understand anthropology or you only understand English. And I can't tell you the number of times I've seen faculty have these aha moments when there's talking to each other across disciplines, and they're realizing that maybe English, sociology, history, Near Eastern Judaic studies, music composition theory, that they actually share some really big things in common about these conversations and the challenges, and that actually there are some creative things that are happening that they can actually transport to their own disciplines and departments.
Thank you both so much for being here today, Dr. Alyssa Kennelly and Dr. Jonathan Anjaria, and talking to us about the connected PhD and how we can all make the PhD programs more connected for the students and the professors. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and you've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again.